I'm going to introduce to you my favorite disciple of Srila Prabhupada, foremost Vedic sovereignty, and he's continuing on for traveling the world. And
you have a driver who you persuaded here, so believe it, I expected. I was just thinking of what would be your main concerns, or what should be your main concerns. Obviously, if you're here tonight, you're interested in more than just the routine things in life. So I just wrote down some thoughts about things you might find of interest, because naturally everyone wants to make the best use of their life. Everyone wants to have the feeling that what you're doing is worthwhile. No one wants to waste time, you know. I've been traveling and speaking about these things for over a quarter of a century. It's my university days. Actually, I began my training in spiritual science 30 years ago. I started traveling about 25 years ago. 25 years on every continent of the world, and seen a lot. And what to do with the world? If you practice spiritual life, does it mean that you just kind of turn your back on the world, seal yourself off? Or if you practice spiritual life, does it mean that automatically embrace everything in the world as divine? I'm sure you've heard of both extremes, and you're probably wondering what to do. What's it all about? Do I live a cloistered existence hidden away from the world? Do I just one day wake up and say everything is divine, spiritual, so just do everything and be everywhere? What to do? I often like to tell the story of my last month's university studies. I was at Yale University, and you have your Oxford, Cambridge, Bates, Yale, Harvard. So you were supposed to consider yourself as having made it to the supreme destination. That was my last month, and I was talking to my dean, and I told him, I said, you know, I don't see much future for myself in society as it is now, sitting in front of him, dressed like the normal student of those days, you know, bell-bottom pants, you know, purple color, shirt with the fringe coming off the sleeves. Jimi Hendrix type of hairstyle. So, I was sitting in front of the dean at, you know, Yale University, and I was telling him, I don't see much. He didn't blink an eye. He just looked at me and told me, you are a Yale man. You will influence the world. So, maybe in one sense he was right. Probably not influencing the world in the way that he expected. But still, I'm sure you can appreciate the situation I was in. I had studied so many different courses because my professors, they allowed me, my dean, allowed me to study whatever I wanted to field, all different kinds of history, culture. And I quickly realized after about 2 years into my university career, which was 4 years, how long is it here? 3, 4. Midway through, I had convinced myself through investigating history, studies of culture, anthropology, political science. Unless humanity was open to something higher than itself, there was no hope. Just century after century, the same thing, the same thing. So I began to wonder, well, what am I going to do about the world? I was politically active my first year. Pressure, you just do politics. Everyone was into it then. Cool thing to do. Down with imperialism, down with capital. All power to the people. So I remember when I had my fill of that, I went to the radical students meeting. They were making plans for a big weekend, radical weekend. Radical meant everybody was radical then. the true deviants and the true radical persons were the straight people. At that time, everyone was, you know, countercultural. So they called it, you know, radical students, but that meant everybody. Big difference there. So, yeah, at that time, Yale was still all men. The next year we go co-ed. So the men were having their plans, making their plans for the radical weekend when they would invite people from other universities nearby, especially girls from the nearby all girls posh universities. So now it's all co-ed, but back then it was making their workshop plans, seminars and plenary discussions, how to give power back to the people, how to empower the people, how to break down the establishment. So, on and on, and they were planning their workshops and plenary sessions, and then came time to plan the evening entertainment, particularly the big party. So the person who was coordinating, the revolutionary brother who was coordinating the party, he stood up in front of everyone and said, "Okay, fellas, you know, after a day of tense seminars and plenary discussions for how to bring the revolution to the people, we're having the party." Everybody yelled, "Yeah." He said, "The party's going to end around 1 a.m., 2 a.m., and if by 2 a.m. you realize you failed, in other words, if you haven't made your way to a motel room with one of the revolutionary sisters, then why don't you stick around and help clean up the party area?" I don't know. That was it for me. No more politics. This is what always comes down to. I just said, forget it. That was my last interest in making political speeches. So at that point, I thought the only hope is to change consciousness. I also realized that from studying so many histories, revolutions, and so on and so forth. No change happens. So I thought, how not to waste my life? How can I actually do something that has real benefit for people, real benefit for myself? This is what I was thinking about when in my last month, I placed myself in society. So I can understand when students wonder, well, I don't really want to go the route that everybody's going. At the same time, is there anything else? And I mean, am I just supposed to turn my back on the world? I don't know if that's the best thing to do. What do you do about the world? So I wrote down some thoughts for me to share them with you. I figured I would entitle this discussion, "Stop the World, I Want to Get On." Generally, most people think if you take up the spiritual life, it's "Stop the World, I Want to Get Off." But I'd like to present to you the opposite viewpoint, but actually take up genuine spiritual life, getting on the world. So what is the issue here? What do I do about the world? But say I'm going to take up Krishna consciousness. They look like nice people, those Krishna conscious people. They've got focus, they've got knowledge, they've got precision. They've got the heart and the head combined. Okay, check it out. But what do I do about the world? And what does the world do about me? Whether I'm a spiritual newcomer or a committed enthusiast, do I like immediately shun the world of pleasures and pains? Do I immediately reject the matrix of illusion, take the red pill, and enter a totally different realm? Or do I just say, now that I'm practicing spiritual life, I just accept everything as spiritual? I'm sure you've met people like that. They just use the word spiritual for everything. It's like athletes, when they win a championship, they say, "Oh, it was a spiritual feeling." Or someone will say about their partner, "Oh, he's spiritual, he's divine, she's spiritual." So we can go to that side also, that extreme also. Just everything that happens is all, it's all as it should be. Just recognize that and you'll be happy. Or should we just, it's all the matrix of illusion, it's not as it looks, reject it all. First, let's discuss this from the basic biological point of view. You'd be surprised what biology can teach you about how necessary human beings are to this world. It's amazing how human beings consider themselves essential for this world. What are we going to do about the world? How are we going to relate to the world? When you look at human beings and this world strictly from a materialistic viewpoint, without considering any spiritual aspirations, human beings are nothing but a disturbance to the planet. The best thing we could do, beings from the materialistic point of view, is just to leave the planet alone, just go off somewhere else. It'd be much better without us. One very famous biologist, E.O. Wilson, of our age, holds forth at Harvard University. He makes a very interesting point that if all humanity disappeared, the rest of life would benefit enormously. The biosphere would literally breathe a sigh of relief, as forests regenerated and endangered species revived. So, he can show this from the biological point of view, that if human beings disappear from this world, the rest of life would benefit extraordinarily. Not only that, but from the material point of view, the presence of human beings in this world is totally unnecessary. What does that mean? That means that if any other species would disappear from this world, there would be problems. If any other species disappeared, let's say you just took away all the ants, then there would be great imbalances caused. Major extinctions of other species would result. There would be partial collapse of some ecosystems. You just took any other species. Human beings, from strictly from the biological point of view, are the only species that, if you take them out of this world, there'll be no damage whatsoever to the ecosystem. It's amazing. Any other species, even as tiny as ants, if you take them away, there'll be an imbalance created. There'll be disturbance to the ecosystems. Something will collapse. Not human beings. So that shows you that from the material point of view, human beings really aren't that valuable. Now, does that mean, you know, they have no value at all? Of course not. But we should be motivated to find out the real purpose of human beings being around, is their raison d'être. It's not material. When you look at this world, the only purpose can be spiritual. Because from the material point of view, as we said, you can take all the human beings off this planet, and there'd be no problem whatsoever. In fact, the planet would be better from the material point. No other species can do that. But if you look at the human potential from the spiritual point of view, then that's something. So if we're going to really think about what we should be doing with our life, we have to consider that the human form of life is very precious in terms of spiritual development. But in terms of material development, it's not very precious at all. In fact, it's quite expendable. Knowing this, we should seek to shape our life, our human life, so we can achieve its true potential. The ancient Vedic tradition, the ancient Vedic knowledge, known in the contemporary context as Krishna consciousness, holds that it's very special to get a human body, for a living entity to get the human body. Very special thing. So the worst tragedy we can make as human beings is to neglect our dynamic spiritual development, because that's really the only advantage that human beings have. The only thing that really makes them valuable. It's not material. It's only the spiritual. So let's say that you all want to begin your spiritual development. Now, how will your friends, how will your family take it? They start seeing you chanting some mantras. They start seeing you reading books that they can't pronounce the titles of. They start seeing you kind of not so frantic, not so prone to plug into what they're into. And at first they're a bit curious. What's this new thing you're into? Because they expect it all pass, you know. They figure you just like latched on to some new consumer item, and you'll, after you consume it, you'll move on to the next thing. But then they start noticing it's not going away. And so they start to poke you a little bit. They're still kind of amused, because you know, you haven't been doing it too long. They just kind of poke you. And what do they usually say? I hear this all the time. All right, so you're getting a bit spiritual, aren't you? What are you going to do about the real world? And you don't know what to say. You know, you're still green. You're still in your tender stage, so you should start shaking your boots. Ooh, the real world. It sounds like, you know, it's a real, like, just brush off, you know? Like, you know, you're just out of it, you know? You're getting out there, you know? You're not relating to the real world. And you just allow yourself to get intimidated in that way. Because after all, there are billions of people who are living a materialistic lifestyle. Who are you to think you're going to go a different road? So when they say that to you, what are you going to do about the real world? It's like you hear like, you know, billions of people saying the same thing in your ear. What are you going to do about the real world? And you just kind of get up your knees, shake it up. So I hear this happening to so many persons. And if you're going to be truthful in your spiritual infancy, you have to say, well, I don't know. You just have a feeling that there's got to be something better. You have the feeling that you're tired of slogging through life with no knowledge of who you are, why you're in the world. You have that feeling, you know. Why should I live? I don't know who I am. I don't know why I'm in this world. Where did I come from? Where am I going? You have that intuition. That's more than intuition. You have that deep feeling. And not only that, you have some kind of conviction about your non-material identity. You can't prove it, but you wouldn't be able to hold your own with a biology teacher about the non-material identity of a living entity, but still, you've got an intuition, you've got a deep feeling that, yeah, we're more than that. We've got to be something spiritual. And you have some ambitions. Yeah, I'd like to have at least the preliminary experience of enlightenment. I mean, not that I want to be the Dalai Lama or something. He's supposed to be enlightened. Whatever, you know. But not that I may want to be a Hare Krishna. I'm pretty enlightened too. But at least a preliminary experience, you know. That'll do it, you know. Not the full course, but just, you know. And then if you are a bit savvy in terms of understanding the contemporary knowledge scene beyond what they teach undergraduates, if you're a bit aware of controversies in current fund of human knowledge, you'll know that there's so much beyond what we now call science, so much that has not been resolved, has not been understood. So if you understand that, then you're open automatically for different ways of looking at things, different ways of explaining things. So all these things add up, but still it's not enough to help you deal with those persons who are going to assume that they are all of humanity. It's all of humanity against you. We are the real world. What are you going to do?
I just feel that there's something spiritual going on, you know. I just really like to kind of, follow my spiritual intuition and kind of, you know.
And he's kind of looking at you. The real world, what are you going to do about it? It throws a lot of people, you know. Or sometimes they just become more direct. What are you going to do about money? How are you going to get money in this world? How are you going to have fun? How are you going to have sex? Yeah, something to say like that. Come on, don't you know what that's it's all about?
I've heard this before.
So you know, it's just kind of overwhelming for a spiritual novice. You know, you've just been chanting a few mantras for a few weeks. You know, thumbed your way through Bhagavad Gita, you know, and you hung out with Ranganathan and Komala, and you were feeling a bit good about yourself, and yeah, you're spiritual too. Until you met these persons who just kind of punctured your balloon, you know. You just imagine them saying, hey, it's Friday night. You're going to let your spiritual stuff stop you from a Friday night? Come on. Another thing people say is, okay, look, you can be a bit spiritual, but there has to be a balance. There has to be a balance. Of course, who determines the balance? The balance is whatever you make it. It's not that you have to turn your back on the world completely, as if that's what practicing genuine spiritual art means, to turn your back on the world completely. See, often you allow yourself to be maneuvered into these corners. You shouldn't let it happen, but instead of turning your back on the world as if you're doing that, you just have to have a balance. Now, 9 times out of 10, when people say that, they're meaning, you know, just leave yourself open for the traditional vices. There's a place for the traditional vices. That's basically what they mean. But instead they say, you have to have a balance. So, how do I explain that one? I tell people that we're all into pleasure. There's no doubt about it. The only question is how to get the best possible pleasure the most possible time. So, if indeed you are having superior pleasure, why would you want to balance the superior pleasure with the lower pleasure? It's in your self-interest to have the superior pleasure all the time. Admitting there is such a thing as superior pleasure. The person says, yeah, there's better and better pleasure. Okay, so if I'm into the superior pleasure and I'm tasting that, then why would I want to kind of waste time with lower pursuits of pleasure? I want the best all the time. Why would I want to balance the lower with the higher? I just want the higher. That usually starts to get them thinking. If we accept that naturally the living entity is pleasure-seeking, then we should discuss what is the best possible pleasure. The whole world is pursuing pleasure. So the Krishna conscious person is not turning his or her back. It's a question of what is the best pleasure for oneself and others. That is the whole point. Now, you know what most people do during the day. You know what most people do during the night. I wrote a bit of a description for one newspaper, university newspaper. You listen and see if you think it's appropriate. The daytime of the sensually overwhelmed person means complicated, often computerized versions of basic Neanderthal pursuits. Hunting and gathering, we muscle and connive our way through the forest of education and employment. Darkness falls, and then we seek release. We pin our hopes for catharsis on a nocturnal brew of television, intoxication, and sex. Then the warm blanket of sleep grants us a reprieve. Soon day breaks, and the cycle of intense struggle renews. I'm trying to communicate that life as it's lived for most people in the so-called real world is a complete struggle. People are struggling to get the pleasures that will make their life worthwhile as they see it. It's a struggle, both day and night. So, why is that struggle the real world? So I concluded, why do we take what is so tedious, deadening, and self-destructive and anoint it as the real world? How do we submit to such low expectations of human potential? So instead of considering the way people live their days and nights as the real world, instead of taking such low aspirations, such tediousness, such monotony, why should we consider that the real world? Why not consider the highest spiritual aspirations as the real world? So basically, I would think that you're starting to see there's competition or conflict even between what is the real world. In Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna points this out in the second chapter, that what is night for the materialist is day for the spiritualist, and vice versa. There's no agreeable standard between spirituals and materialists as to what the real world is. Basically, you have to take your pick. Is your real world that place of the lowest aspirations, or is your real world that place of the highest aspirations? And then you mold your life accordingly. How to translate all that into your university situation? Well, we all know that going to university has, to a great deal, has an economic motivation. And then also, without a doubt, when you're at the university, you want to expand your vision, learn some things you didn't know, and develop, explore. We have to evaluate our time in university. What is this really doing for my ultimate goals? Okay, one has to earn a wage, one has to support oneself. But is that the most important thing in my life? And how much time and effort am I putting into my most important goals? Without that constant reevaluation of your energies and how your energies are being used, you can really become swept away by so much unnecessary complexity. Or you can just become morose. During my university days, I would alternate between the two, overwhelmed by complexity, or sometimes just morose. What's the point of all this? Other times I'd be very active. We need to have some higher pursuits in our life. I'm sure that if you add Krishna consciousness to your university lifestyle, things will become quite clear. Krishna consciousness means that there's energy and then the source of all the energy. If you want to know how to use the energy, the best information about how to use the energy comes from the source of all the energy. Krishna consciousness means to be conscious of Krishna, the source of everything. And then you know how to deal with everything because you're getting your information from the source. So naturally you've got all the situations covered. Sometimes people say, okay, sounds good. And yeah, you know, you people look kind of, you know, spiritual. Look like you're, you know, most of you look pretty spiritual. One or two of you may be a bit spaced out. Most of you look pretty spiritual. So, why do you have to do it as a group? Why do you have to, you know, assume the form of some kind of, you know, I don't know for sure, but things look a bit organized sometimes. Why do you have to bunch together? Who knows? Why are we doing it? Why can't we study on our own?
Some person can
buy books and teach themselves at home. Obviously, you're not doing that because you hope to benefit from organized context. Share the same vision, and you want some kind of organized setting for your endeavors. That's why you're at a university. Otherwise, all of you, you could just go to a shop, get some books, read them at home. But you have chosen to do your studies in an organized setting because you think there'll be some benefit to that. There'll be other persons to rub shoulders against and, you know, bounce things off of. There'll be advantages of an organized setting for learning. You'll have some way of judging yourself, how much progress you're making. Similarly, in spiritual life, it's also the same thing. Everyone is always an individual. Besides, just because you go to the university doesn't mean you are not an individual anymore. But it's just that you find the particular setting to be advantageous for your goals. Practicing Krishna consciousness is the same thing. You're an individual, but you see advantages in working with others. You see advantages in some degree in organized context, to some degree, not in everything. See advantages in some kind of coordination. There's nothing more than that. So whenever people say things like, yeah, and that's what you're doing. I mean, you are a nice speech, sound like you know what you're talking about. But then they say, why can't you just do it by yourself? Why do you have to kind of look like a... Well, I could say that, what are you doing at university? Why can't you study at home? Why are you going to a... And you'll say, well, you know, just because I'm going to university doesn't mean like I'm just a clone. I'm an individual. I know how to, you know, pick and choose my way through the system. It's just that there are advantages, you know, social advantages. Get to meet others, share, enrich in each other's understanding. You get graded and you get some idea of, you know, where you're at and what your abilities are. Similarly, to practice spiritual life with others also has those advantages. Still, it's true. Some people can study at home and they'll become very educated. But most people aren't like that. I know for myself, when I became interested in Krishna consciousness a month after I graduated, I got a hold of some Krishna conscious books, started reading them, and really liked them. So I just read them at home 4 hours a day for 6 months straight. I never went to any meeting like this or anything. My notion was, these Krishna conscious books are great, but the Krishna conscious people there were strange. That was my notion. So I said, I'll read all their books at home, but I'll never go to a meeting. I'll never go to anything like this, forget it. Yeah, that's what I thought. So some people can do like that for a while. They can do an independent study course. Still, there are advantages to varying degrees for different persons who be part of like a network of spiritual practitioners. So I'd rather use the term network religion. Religion sounds like, you know, pretty stodgy and Middle Ages. I prefer to use the term network of spiritual practitioners. Feed off of each other and inspire each other and sometimes give each other a hard time, but well, generally have a very good time together. So I don't really myself get into the religion kind of thing. Then you have other people who assume that as soon as there are some kind of strict systems and behavioral expectations, that, oh, that's not good. If there's some kind of regulations and codes of behavior, then, oh, that's very archaic. But at the university, you have regimens, you have regulations, You can't just come to the universe and do whatever you like. There are certain things you're supposed to do in order to get the result. Similarly, in genuine spiritual practice, there are things you do and things you don't do. No need to make more of it than that. You have to decide yourself if you want the result. So in conclusion, I'd like you to just consider a different version of what the real world is. You make the real world a place of the highest spiritual aspiration. Why should you let those with such low aspirations, such tedious aspirations, define what is the real world? Shouldn't let that happen. By a genuine process of spiritual development, you can improve not only your own situation, you can work with others to improve theirs. That's the real world. Alright, I guess I'll stop there. Maybe you have some questions about any points you want to make. What are you studying?
Foundation.
What's that?
Art.
Art. All types of art, any particular sculpture, painting? So what would motive, what do you see as your future? You could have just been an artist on your own, you know? Why did you choose to sell out and go study art at university? Why didn't you just play the starving artist role and just, you know?
I'd be able to do at home.
So what do you hope to do upon your completion of university?
Not much.
You're studying? You could have done it on your own, you know?
Yeah.
You could have gotten, there's so many photography magazines, right? So many books. What made you decide to...
I think collected online.
Oh, you mean on your own you might have considered... That's honest. But do you agree with her that for you there's some facilities here you can use and things like that?
Yeah, but
with Did you get any inspiration from being around other photographers, or you could have also done that on your own?
I haven't heard that
on my own.
It's quite a lonely
thing. Yeah,
it's not
like that. Oh, really? I thought you kind of share tips and techniques now.
Only if you've got really good friends on the course.
So this is like an art expression for you, and do you hope that one day you'll come out with a famous picture that will win an award or something, or is this your own fulfillment?
That's already happened.
Ah.
I won an award, but no.
How did you feel when you won the award?
I was just really happy, but everyone else being happy for me.
For a split second, hey, that's really good. For a split second, I felt really happy. That's a very precise statement. And everyone else was—they were happy. They were happy for you, right?
Yeah.
Not
for long, though.
Not for long. No one got envious. Like, why her? What was the award that you won?
Best
for
journalism.
National
journalism.
For all of. So was it some money or just fame?
£500.
Not for a vacation in Spain.
It's just gone, maybe. I left my bank.
You didn't treat yourself to a holiday or something?
No, I went away anyway.
What was the award-winning picture of?
My two cousins, black and white photos. My two cousins. I was going to take the both ones to go first. So one started crying, but I picked the other one to go first. One was crying, the other one got.
You know, you're giving me some ideas. I always had this dream of wanting to take pictures or not so much take them myself, but get a collection of pictures which showed people where they're really at, you know? Are there any collections of photos like that which can capture the stark realities of material life, you know? Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah? Are there particular collections just like that, or just...
Particular photographers that take pictures of women or black people and ghosts.
Right, whatever they are, the agonies and the so-called ecstasies, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's photos of everything.
And they publish books of these?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd like to see one if you can. Because when I'm speaking around the world, I always give real-life examples because I've been to on every continent in the world. I always wish that there were pictures that would convey these kind of scenarios which I see everywhere. Just like the scenario you just described. That's a whole, you could make a whole commentary on that in itself. You know what I mean? If there's an example of the old cliche of picture speaks a thousand words. So. I thought myself that I, of course, I never thought I would have the time to do such a thing, but I, somebody would do it. Just, hmm?
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I see when I'm walking around or traveling in the world, I see so many scenes because if your eye is trained for that, if you know how to look beneath the veil of, you know, everything is all right and everything is fine, you know how to pull back that veil and see what's really going on, you see so many things. I just sometimes wish that I happy to be captured on film. I've also thought of using a projector while I speak, because these multimedia projectors are getting ripped. But where do I get real photos of real life scenes? Just like a picture that you talked about, I could talk for a half hour at least just on that one picture. You know, what it's all about. And you see scenes on the street, like a common scene I see, particularly around universities, is a guy and girl standing on a street corner about to cross the street, and suddenly they, you know, they give each other, you know, a kiss, you know, and I can just see that there's some kind of false exhilaration that it kind of tastes better in the public street.
Yeah,
you know, every time is that it's kind of like I don't know, like they've done it millions of times, but here on this street corner, there's some kind of special excitement. I can see that. So, how do you get a photo of that kind of thing? It's like there's some special electricity to it all, just because they're doing this on the street corner. When they've done it so many times before, I can see the kind of the glint in their eyes. You know, wow, isn't this exciting? So how to capture that with a camera, I always thought. Or then, 5 years later, if their relationship lasts that long, it's totally different. You can see, you know, they both got a distant look in their eyes. Even though they're walking together, you know, they've got their eyes on different things. Mm-hmm. No, I don't know anything. Really? Wow! Wow, I'm really excited now. Yeah, no, tell me more.
Yeah, just couples, like you say, just staring
into
space or just sitting at a table.
Right. Yeah, that's what I... And he's got like a published collection?
Yeah.
Really? You have to write these things down for me. You have them?
I might have.
Oh, please. I'd love to see them. And the other thing, the other hobby I wanted to develop was pictures of old movie stars, hairmen, when they were in their prime. Just like if you look at the bombshells of, let's say, the 50s and 60s. Look at them now. Quite revealing. I remember, let's say, when I was a teenager, who was a bombshell? Sophia Loren. Now if you see a picture of Sophia Loren. Yeah. A withered old lady. But when I was a young lad, you know, she was a bombshell. You know, she was, you know. Another famous one was Brigitte Bardot. She was a French bombshell, but you see a picture of where she looks now. Then you see the reality of the material life. That's what I like to do. I've had this idea for so long that I could execute it. Because when people see those things, they can understand better. Everything is so visual these
days.
Yeah, but how would I, you know, to capture those kind of things, you have to have some kind of, it's one thing to be able to think it, but to actually get the technology to follow suit. That's another thing, isn't it? Yeah. Not that hard, as I'm making it out to you? Like, where would you look to find pictures of old movie stars?
Old movie stars? I think some big names come to the deal with celebrity culture, high arts, just the high celebrity culture, that, you know, this kind of fake reality that we're all kind of pursuing. Very harsh black and white image, but I don't know if you're supposed to sit together. Well, I think what you said about yourself, I think it would be really good, because for you to take up, not to become a photographer, but, you know, just to carry, like, have the documentation, because you also, then other people can put out a veil, the owner of the veil, you see so much more.
Yeah.
It's today's an idea, as opposed to don't have to worry about anything else, besides the camera and at the moments.
Really?
They get the... It'd be like the ugly talks.
You really think an ordinary non-Arab can do something like that, really? Like, to get the picture you got of your, what is it,
cousins.
I mean, that had to, you had to have some expertise with.
Not really.
It was just an ordinary picture? You didn't, it wasn't any, you didn't soup it up in any way or anything? Or?
No, those are the best ones I get soup.
You just, that's all? Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the best ones are the ones where you catch a skate on there, like, what most people ignore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I see.
The,
yeah.
You see the things that most people ignore. Mm-hmm. That's what makes a picture.
Oh, I see. Wow. Yeah, I'm learning something.
Yeah.
But if you can show me some examples, that would really help out a lot. I'd be more inspired then. Because I go to so many places in the world. I mean, the places I've been to, most people just dream about, you know. I've been doing it for 25 years. I spent 8 years behind the Iron Curtain, underground. I went to communist China in the 80s, Russian Iron Curtain, and been on every continent in the world. Not as a tourist, but as part of the scene, part of the fabric. And people are always bugging me now, especially with the digital camera technology now. Why don't you take pictures? Get a projector. You go so many places, we want to see. Yeah. I have my cell phone. But it's not so complicated, huh?
No.
If you show me, if you would show me, you know, like if you showed me your picture, your award-winning picture, I might get inspired. If you show me collections, I might get a feel for it, you know? Some things when I was at university, I didn't study, stay with Yale University, they wouldn't teach photography, but they taught history of the cinema. I studied history. I have a conceptual understanding. It's not ever manifested in practice. I can do it in writing. That's my art form. My media art form is writing. But still, things are much more visual these days now than ever before. I recognize that. I just don't yet figure out how to add the visual element. Especially now that the projector prices are way down, because what they want to do, the manufacturers, is they've already saturated the business market, so now they want to saturate the home market, so they've bought the prices so far. They're like 25% of what they sell, and they're becoming lighter and lighter. I have this idea, I keep toying with it, but always just on the verge. But if you can show me, there are whole collections, like books of pictures about these kind of things. They have them in libraries, because they're pretty expensive to buy, aren't they?
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
a good
bookshop is a good
book. Well, if you could help me do that, it would really... and you also, that would really help out, you know? That I would be inspired to do something. So I go everywhere in the world, you know?
How long are you in
there? This is my European base. I have two bases. One's down under in New Zealand, to my northern base. So I'm in and out of Manchester all the time. I'm generally here 2 or 3 years. I go to Russia, Ukraine, Hungary. And then I go through the USA, or South America, or Africa, through Australia, New Zealand, the place in the Spice Church. I'm around on an ongoing basis. I'll be here until Tuesday, and I'm going to India for a month. There's a photogenic place. After India, I come back here for a couple of weeks in March, from March 5th to March 8th, Prague, for one day, because I haven't seen Prague since communist days, my underground days. I've never seen a Prague without the communists. Last time I went to one of those countries for the first time, I went to Hungary for the first time since communist days when I was a fugitive there. I got hounded all over the country by newspaper reporters and on national television. And then one tabloid newspaper in Budapest, and one photographer, I thought she was just taking she had a digital, fancy digital camera, and then she took a picture of me just sitting cross-legged, and I looked in the newspaper the next day, and there's the color photo, but she had it, the image manipulated, made me look like a Buddha sitting across. So, yeah, if you could, let me know those kind of things. I'm going to be inspired. Well, as everyone's always telling me, it's so many opportunities. Like, I go also above the Arctic Circle to the northernmost city in the world, Murmansk in Russia. All these exotic places. But mainly I like watching people. Not so much into watching scenery and things like that. So I just never thought that photographers should have known, but you don't find those kind of pictures in ordinary magazines, do you? Are there special publications where those kind of pictures are, or just special collections? Under themes or by a particular photographer? Alright, well, if you could show me an economical way how to do that. But you're also studying?
I'm a research graduate.
Ah.
Same research.
Ah. So what are you doing now?
I'm practicing being a poor artist.
Practicing being poor artist?
Practicing being a poor artist.
Ah, I see. So, how long will that last for?
Until I sell out, I think. Until I reserve some cash during the Davis job. But I'm quite happy, because at the moment I'm not working as a photographer.
Oh, where are you going?
I'm kind of doing things. I'm doing lots of things that doesn't involve me committing myself to one full time. At the moment I'm kind of showing my work around. Having many exhibitions. I do a film course as well. So.
Film course?
Yeah.
Oh, here. Isn't that another realm film?
Yeah. Oh, quite open really, that surprised me. It's something I quite often do. The financial gain from it.
How do you support yourself?
How do I support myself?
The real world, you know?
The real world?
Yeah, the real world.
Financially, well, in terms of, well, the biggest financial battle is kind of, you don't have like rent and, you know, so, quite lucky that I live in Manchester, like my parents are in Manchester.
Oh.
I live with my parents at home, so I speak financial now.
They don't mind.
I don't mind at all, actually.
They don't mind.
I'm normally out of the house all day, not to sleep. I don't help out at home as well.
Well, I gotta admit, I kind of seen this movie before, so, with my friends and like that. So what usually happens is that although life is simple now, very quickly it becomes more complicated, especially because, no one's an island, and sooner or later it's another, and then, you have to start considering how are two persons going to make their way through the world. And then, sooner or later, everyone likes to settle down one way or another. So you say you just kind of cross that bridge when you come to it.
Well, I said that the spiritual, if you like, comes to these meetings. That's not a great influence direction of my, like, future.
Mm-hmm.
Future would present itself to me.
I agree. Don't think I was always, so focused. Charmaine can tell you the first time I saw Krishna conscious practitioners was on television. My last month at Yale, I was writing my senior thesis. Flatmate was studying for his physics final. He was a physics combination of sociology, history, political science, and this and that. So I didn't have to take an exam. I had to write a final paper. So we both wanted some relief from our studies, so we turned on the TV, and I always like to explain that we weren't ordinary students, we were Yale students. So that meant we wouldn't watch television in the way that the ordinary masses would watch television. Yeah. So we would watch television with the volume turned down and speculate on what was going on. Because we were the cream, So I saw these. All of a sudden, I saw on the television these strange-looking people, wearing these different kind of dress and bald heads. And so I told my flatmate, "Turn on the TV, turn it up. Let's see what these people say. This was really strange." So we listened. They were explaining their lifestyle, rising early in the morning. So our lifestyle as students was go to sleep at 3 and wake up at 11. I would never take a class, before 11 o'clock in the morning. I remember a few times I had to take a class and met at 10 o'clock. Whoa. Ideal is 11. Most of the time we could do that. Forget it, 8 o'clock, forget it. So they're talking about their lifestyle, their Krishna consciousness, so rising early, mantra meditation. And then they started mentioning about their, kind of behavioral restraints they followed. Know this, that, especially know that. I remember I turned to my flatmate and I said, "They've missed the goal of life." I still remember this day. I remember what I said. "They're talking about bliss and true pleasure. We'll invite them to one of our parties. We'll show them what bliss is. So you see that. There was a transformation, a change in consciousness. Less than 1 year after I said that, I was full-time practitioner at Krishna. I graduated a month later, and then by 7 months later, I was a trainee to be a monk. So, yes, if either or both of you could help in showing me, finally convincing me of that anyone has the capability to take meaningful pictures, okay, and I'd appreciate it. You show me some books. I just get this feeling photography is such a complicated thing, you know. You just have to be adjusting all these variables and sit in front of people's faces and, you know, while they pose. You're a photography student too? But it's not like it, huh?
No, I do want to do, but at the moment I'm writing an essay, the version of an essay, about my style, and I've changed it a bit, so I'm using a little camera now, because it's less, you know, I don't like posed pictures.
Really. You can show me how it's possible to take meaningful pictures that aren't posed. I don't understand that. I thought you said, okay, we're going to take a picture of you. So how do you get a good shot of someone, you know, you have to have a very good camera? I thought you always have to be adjusting the this is in the that's and the other, and
no.
No,
you just use a simple, like, disposable camera, and if the people around you, that, you know, your friends are comfortable around you, then they're not posing, they're just natural.
Oh, I see. If you have all those big fancy whatevers, and everybody, they automatically become a little
sometimes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because you know that so many new digital cameras are so small and this and that. All right, well, if you can, you can show me that, I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, I'll bring some books.
Oh, that'd be great. Because, I mean, I do agree, it is a bit of a waste. I mean, how many people get to go to every continent in the world? I go around the world 3 times a year. I mean, this is kind of unusual. And not to tell, you know, people are always telling me that, well, you want to just take some pictures, you know? It's just not fair.
So everyone else can see.
Yeah. But I don't want to take posed pictures.
Yeah.
I'm not into that. I just never knew there was an alternative. And I thought to take pictures that were not posed, you needed, you know, all sorts of a big fancy camera, you know. Otherwise, if the person moves, it's a blur, or this or that, or the other, or the lighting, or this or that. Not like that, huh?
Nope.
Well, that's a bit hit and miss. Some photos come out, or some photos come out, or the disposable one as well.
What?
The disposable cameras as well. Sometimes, like, if it's too bright or something, you know, like it.
Yeah, that's I don't expect perfection in this world, but you know, in law of averages, you know, if 5 out of 10 are come out exciting, I'll be satisfied.
Yeah.
All right, please, if you could, I would.
Yeah, I'll bring the stuff.
Thanks. Can I go all over South America, Peru, all these exotic places, you know?
Yeah.
Don't
worry, how can you afford to travel?
It's not that, doesn't, just like she's explaining to me how, you know, my conceptions of photography, I actually, it's not a big deal. Similarly, if you know how to travel, it's not a big deal. It's cheaper to fly around the world than, let's say, you know, London to Moscow and back. That kind of flying is very expensive, but when you get an around-the-world ticket, it's very cheap, because most people can't do that. See, I don't have to worry about where I stay. I don't have to worry about room or board. So the airlines make around-the-world tickets very cheap, because most people have to worry that when I go to Paris, I'm going to have to stay in an expensive hotel and eat at an expensive restaurant. I don't have those worries. So by flying around-the-world ticket, it's very, very cheap. And where I go, you know, they contribute for the airfare, because I don't, how much do I need to live on? I don't have a family.
Do you ever want a family?
No. No. My mother hasn't gotten over it yet, but no. No. And then, yes, I wanted to make the whole world my family. I just didn't want a biological family, which is very small. I wanted the whole world as my family, and that's what happened. Mm-hmm. Now I have relatives everywhere. And by meeting people here and there, things expand. I met Sharon Raina, she came to New Zealand for holiday. Right? And at that time, I never expected to come to England to me. I never wanted a family, but in my materialistic days, before I had some disadvantages, I definitely was a male exploiter. That's normal. Well, I wasn't ever thinking of wanting a family. Mm-hmm. You know, but, you know, every university guy, you know, needs a girlfriend to exploit, you know. That's the way it is, you know. But then when I started studying Krishna consciousness, I realized what that was all about. The men think that they're gaming, so much, and actually they're destroying themselves. In the of course, nowadays, the ladies think that they can play the same game. But it's not a game, it's a disaster. The men are already burnt out doing it. Now the ladies want to try. University in Liverpool, he was telling me about the pressure week and how some area of Liverpool, 6,000 students just crawling from pub to pub, you know, pressure week. And they're all being exhorted that this is the week where you get as drunk as much as you can and have as many random connections as you can. It's the way you do it. And so all thousands of students were caught up in this. Both the men and the women. During my university days, the men would be the wolves and the women would be the passive victims. But now both are the wolves. Mm-hmm. No worries. We've been discussing what is the real world as integrated with genuine spiritual practice. We've also been discussing photography. Mm-hmm. Fascinating discussion of photography. You don't need like zoom lenses and all that kind of stuff. Well, I just thought unless you have a zoom lens, you got to be real. You got to get really close to the person.
Yeah.
You made this stuff.
No, I bought it.
It's film or digital? It's film.
Yes, yeah, film.
And you take award-winning photos with this?
No, that one, because I just bought it, but it takes four pictures in one, so in the frame, a 10-year frame divided into four, and one is, like each one's a bit closer than the one before.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, it's quite cool.
Yeah, it is. So you just...
No, I haven't got a zoom.
So you just walk around and take your spontaneous pictures of me?
Yeah.
Oh, this is yours. That's it. Oh, you got lenses there. Yeah, see that? That's what scares me, all that stuff, you know? Shutter speeds and...
Is it going to happen? Focus.
This is a digital?
No, it's film.
How do you...
Sorry. Mm-hmm. If you move this in and out, that's just
you. Oh, okay.
It's a sort of stuff if you focus.
That's all you have to do. Yeah, you just move this in and out and turn this in and when it becomes clear, then you take the picture. Yeah, that's not too complicated. Is this a SLR? Oh, so that's what an SLR is all about? You don't have to, like, where's your light meter, you know, in here? Didn't it?
The light meter built in.
So, just by focusing, turning this?
You still have to adjust your shutter speed and aperture according to the light in the room.
That's just something you develop a feel for?
It's quite simple. There's three lights in there. Mm-hmm. When you push the button down halfway, there's a plus, a minus, a green. Mm-hmm. So overexposure, underexposure, and it's getting green by turning the dials. Ready to take a picture.
Ah.
Can I take a picture?
Yeah, please. Go ahead. So that's all there is to an SLR?
That's all there is to an SLR.
Really? I thought, you know...
You can complicate things if you want to complicate things. Mm-hmm. introduce the light meter, like a dedicated instrument to measure the light in the room.
Yeah, you shouldn't be showing me these people,
right? Like you're on flash, you know, in low light conditions or... but also true, but you can keep it simple. It's all simple really, but you just look at it into the day and just think that you're supposed to die with silly bits.
It's an expensive hobby?
It's not that expensive. Not at all.
I mean, no more expensive than having a computer or something. Really? So what's the digital equivalent of an SLR? They don't call them SLRs.
You do get digital SLRs.
Ah?
Yeah. Exactly.
Like that.
Slightly bigger.
Thanks, girl. You're a photography student too?
I'm not.
All right, I'll be ready for my education. You got me intrigued. It may be possible. It'll be a good test of your knowledge, because if you can teach something, that means you really know. Oh, that's what scared me. How can he ever catch a picture of somebody without them posing? Yeah.
Capture when they visit.
All right. So, nice meeting you all. Which day? Okay. I'm interested now. I'm going to start to think it's possible. Thank you all for your splendid association.